Welcome to Next Us 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I'm your host, Dr. JC. This episode of Next Us 818 Podcast focuses on the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion, the only all-female black battalion to serve in the European theater of operations during World War II. If you're tuning in to the podcast for the very first time, I encourage you to check out the inaugural episode from September the 7th of 2022 to learn about the background of the 6888 Battalion. In most episodes, I have interviewed 6888 descendants. In episode 31, we will talk with an international 6888 ambassador and historian in Birmingham, England, where the 6888 Battalion served.
My guest tonight is Gary Stewart, Director of Recognized Black Heritage and Culture. Welcome, Gary.
Good afternoon, Doc. I'd like to say thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure.
Well, I'm glad you were able to join us from Birmingham. I want to pronounce it correctly. Birmingham, England, right?
Absolutely spot on. Thank you.
All right. Okay. I always like to start with a few interesting facts. Your organization, Recognized Black Heritage and Culture, raises awareness of the valiant contributions of Black servicemen and women during World War I and World War II. And it promotes positive diversity by educating people about the heritage and culture of the African Caribbean community.
Yeah, that's me, absolutely, in a nutshell.
And the second fact is that you're a British military veteran having served in Desert Storm.
Yeah, I was in Desert Storm. So that version, our version of it was called Operation Granbury. I think it was the US that was Desert Storm, but I was on that actual particular deployment.
Okay, so yours was called Operation?
Granby,
okay, all right. Yeah.
So I think Americans have a better sounding name than ours. Desert Storm, Granby, yes, yeah, definitely.
Well, it's a Desert Storm is certainly very descriptive of that part of the world, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about the 6888. You and I met this past June during the 6888 Legacy Tour to England, Scotland, and France. And for my audience, check out the Nexus 818 podcast episodes 22, 24, and 25 for a tour recap. So Gary, as I noted, you are a British historian with extensive knowledge about Black servicemen and women. How did you get involved with the 6888 Battalion?
So you have to cast your mind back, probably about 7 or 8 years ago now, if not slightly longer. I was actually Googling a story about African-American men who had been posted in the West Midlands area. That's the region, or as you guys would say, that's the state where I live at the moment. And I was actually trying to piece together a story about African-American nurses who were in the area and African-American mm-hmm. servicemen, engineers that were in the area as well. And I was trying to put together a picture of that story. You can imagine I'm Googling away and I'm getting all kind of pictures and information come up. And all of a sudden, a video pops up of the 6888 walking down the street that, you know, most people have seen this famous picture of them stood outside the huts of the school. So I've actually got a piece of video that is actually them marching into the city centre on their first day here. So I'm looking at this picture and I'm kind of going, hold on, what is this? This is Birmingham, England. And you can imagine I'm cross-referencing, I'm checking. I know, and I'm just stunned to see this black and white picture in almost like perfect condition, telling me a story that, I don't know, two, I haven't heard of, and three, I don't think anybody's actually seen. So that's what started to me then. And I watched the video, I found further versions of it. I found that it was endorsed by the US Army. It was actually filmed by the US Army Film Department. So I'm now excited. I'm so excited. I call my mom and dad into the room. We're going, oh, what's he doing now? And I'm sharing my story with them. You know, I'm sharing this story with them. And then just to jump forward, a really bizarre set of circumstances happened. So for us, it was just before the World War, the centenary of the First World War, which England was celebrating or commemorating, whichever way you want to look at it. And I had been to a meeting of all these city institutions and organisations. And by some bizarre coincidence, the woman who was sat next to me was actually the archivist from the school. So it was a lady called Alison Wheatley. Funny enough, she's coming in the US right now. But like she had said to, we were sat next to each other and she said to me, I'm from King Edward School. So I was like, oh, I need to speak to you afterwards about this other piece of thing that I know. And she just looked at me with a glint in her eye. She goes, do you know? And I was like, do you know? And she goes, yeah, do you know? And we're like, yeah, because what are you talking about? I got the 6AAA. She was like, the 6AAA. She goes, yeah, I didn't know what to do with the story. She goes, she's found it in the archives and I found it. So this is now 2013, I think, actually. So yeah, 2013-ish about then. So she kind of led me to start talking about the 6AAA. She showed me the documents. So she confirmed what we, you know, we had found as well. And the story goes from there, really.
Wow. So why is it so important for you to share the story about the 6AAA? Why do you feel it's so important?
Well, I think for me, first of all, I'm an ex-veteran myself. So the real thing I'm looking at is I tell the story of Black veterans because our place isn't cemented in history. When people want to talk about service, they'll always talk about D-Day, you see white soldiers and stuff. And I thought it was really important once I'd gained an understanding of how Black service personnel were instrumental in the battles, even though it's not talked about today. So that's my starting point from a British American, right the way around the world, anywhere there's Black service personnel, I try to tell that story. Secondly, the school's about 2.5 miles from where I live. So it's a couple of kilometers from where I live and grew up in the area.
That's the King Edward School.
The King Edward School, yeah. So I'm literally a 6-7 minute drive from that actual school. So I've got this excitement of there's a really great piece of history that hasn't been told literally on my doorstep. Who better to tell it than myself? You know, I am from my parents are of Jamaican heritage. They came to England in the 50s and 60s as well. Well, I'm all encompassing. I want to talk about Black military personnel worldwide, you know. So I got excited about that. I then got excited when I realised that this is quite a significant piece of story. Take away just the fact it's African American women. We've got this story of civil rights, social injustice, segregation. The fact that the women were here. And also we've got to tell this little story when people talk about Black service personnel in the UL, in the UK, about this idea of British racism versus US racism. And they're two different things. And, you know, the fact that the British were like, well, you can't bring your type of racism here. And our racism is much polite. And I think it takes for a Black person to speak about what that means. So I kind of self-appointed myself to do that.
So talk about that. What's, from your perception, what's the difference between British racism and American racism? I think we've mastered racism over here, but go right ahead.
So absolutely. So it's not my racism, but this is my opinion, but this is how it actually worked. So the British actually said to the Americans, when you came here, you know, you're in Britain now, you're in our country, you must behave as we do. And even though we have some kind of racism, it's not as bad as yours. It's not as deep, yeah? We're talking about, you know, Jim Crow-type racism that Americans brought and tried to implement here. But the British have actually turned around and said, well, you can't do that here because we don't accept it. But we then know that British have racism as well because they also have a colour bar in recruiting in their own forces at that particular time. Mm-hmm. And eventually, when they bring the two together, they would actually then say to the Americans, well, you can't do this here. And I've just recently watched a video, a welcome video that was sent to American service personnel on how to behave in Britain. And it's quite interesting because part of that theme is picked up about the racism. But like here, British like to say, well, we're welcoming to everybody. But if you ask Black people, be like, well, that's not quite how we feel it here.
Right.
You know, it's just this like idiosyncrasy of having the two different types of racism, but like they're not as bad as each other or, you know, they cancel each other out. And I think it was important for us to talk about it from the British Black population that's already in this country, because we have this idea of telling a story that Black people only came to Britain because of the war, but you had a population that's been here since Hadrian's Wall, going back to Roman Emperor times. So one of the things I'm really keen to do is put things into context and place, you know. And okay, I guess with the US story, it talks about, for me, it particularly talks about what it means to be what we call now African-American in Britain at the time. And, you know, when the servicemen went to dances, they would dance with British white women who were happy to dance with them, you know, and then American soldiers would step in and say, you shouldn't be dancing with them in our country. They're nothing to us as well. So it's really bizarre. I don't know if I've explained it well, but it's really bizarre mm-hmm. to play out the stories of what people were experiencing. There's a famous battle, which is called the Battle of Bamber Bridge, which is US troops against the US military police. Because they were told to arrest them at the time as well. And I think it's just really important we pick out these stories and talk about them as well.
This is kind of maybe a little off track, but really on point. Why do you think that so many Americans who went to Europe decided to stay there rather than come back home? I mean, so many Black Americans, I'm sorry. And I found it curious. You know, you have, if you go back in history, you know, Baldwin and a number of others that they felt that racism here was at racism, sexism, you know, anti-trans, anti-gay was much more intense here than in Europe. But I don't know how to compare it with Europe, and so I was just curious as to, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think you've got to go back about it. So, as you said, we've got to step away from now looking at military history. I think what we've got to look at is, you know, America's style of racism and segregation, what you've been through. As much as ours was a different experience here, it's two completely different things. You know, the racism that was experienced there, what we see here. I mean, we had a Black British Panther Party here. Most people in America don't know about it, but it was actually, we're kind of inspired and led by what happens in the US. It plays right. very heavily lives in Britain as well. So when we're seeing Dr. Martin King and Malcolm X, we're seeing that here on TV here and we're experiencing it, but it's more radical in the US. You know, we're seeing those type of differences as well, but it still informs our experiences here in Britain. And obviously Malcolm X, actually, in fact, both Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King both came to Britain as well, where it's really weird because hundreds of thousands of people turned out to see them at some point, or hundreds in meetings, to hear this experience of American, you know, the American experience of life compared to the British. But people say, we can relate to that. But, you know, it's there are major differences as well. I suppose that's what we're looking for. We're looking at similarities. No matter where you go around the world, Black people experience racism. And no matter how deep on a scale of 1 to 10, it's still racism. And
absolutely.
I think that's really important for us to try and understand. And almost our community, we understand, we come to the US and we understand what it is you guys went through there as well. And we also draw on the fact that we experienced it here too. We draw out the similarities, we draw out the laws, the laws that were actually drawn from those as well. And I think if we look into it deeply, it's about this experience of life. And, you know, the British were very good at exporting racism, you know, as well as exporting people around the world.
Right.
So, yeah, does that make sense? Or
I understand. Yeah. So segue back to the 6AAA. So you've done a lot of research on the 6AAA's time in England. And Birmingham was their first tour of duty in the European Theater of Operations. What interesting and or unique stories can you share about the battalion's experiences there? Anything you've picked up along the way?
Yeah, so I think, again, let's start with, there aren't too many negatives. Well, let's start with the positive things. So the women talked about, you know, for them being an adventure, they came to another city that they probably hadn't heard of before as well. What they were briefed on, I'm not sure before, but when they got here, what they found is a bombed out, badly damaged city, as many cities across Europe were at the time. So you wouldn't have experienced that in the US, but when they came here, that's what they saw. They saw buildings standing and buildings bombed out for the next 10 blocks, you know. They saw people, they saw a city of people that were still continuing to survive, to work, to carry on, to go about their duties and to take part in the war effort. And it's interesting that they came and they felt they were part of that as well. So nobody in the UK would have seen that amount of, you know, as they said, called them at the time as well, which is important, Negro personnel based in Birmingham City Centre. And so, that, you know, it's really interesting to see how they came to the city, they integrated, they went about their duties. One of the things that we did pick up is they were posted on a different side. So we call a posting where they were deployed. So they were deployed to a different side of the city centre, which is actually a nicer side in a way as well. And they were deployed there to be kept separated from the other US troops. So at the time, there were 130,000 US troops based in Birmingham. They were based on one side of the city, and the 6AAA was separated and sent to this other accommodation. Now, we can't say it was 100% deliberate, because they were self-contained as a unit as well. But it is ironic they were posted away from everybody else. And most of the African-American service personnel that were also posted here through the time were actually posted outside of Birmingham City areas, just outside, within about a 50-mile radius.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just unique to pick up that as well. But as soon as they heard that there were African-American women in the city centre, they soon found their way across those 50 miles, you know, to offer support, to build equipment as well. And also to try and, like, you know, mix and attend dances with the women as well. So I just think they just had a major impact, let alone the job that we're doing. And I don't know if I remember telling you this before. So I've had a very similar experience in that when Desert Storm, as you guys call it, or Operation Granby, we were on, I did exactly the same job as them. I cleared backlog mail to British troops who were actually in the Gulf region. But even though I did this back in 1991, it only dawned on me about 15 years later, I was actually giving a presentation and something was tinking in my head and I was like, what's going on? And I thought, hold on, didn't I do this exact job as well? So when I was explaining their story, it's closer to my heart than I actually remembered.
Yeah, yeah.
So can I just go back as well? Sorry, because
Go right ahead.
Yeah, I want to make sure I answered it, yeah. So again, for me, it's to pick up that story, to tell the story of them integrating in the city. They were only here for a short period, but I think it's really important that as part of Birmingham's history, we understand that we had these visitors, these unique visitors here as well, and the fact that they came back. But also, on the negative, it just goes to show how they came and did a job that was like, you know, wasn't expected. 12 months they said they would be here for. They cleared this job in free, and it's just the power of, you know, when Black people do what they need to do, you know, we're very powerful. You know, they said to them, you can't be done. They came up with a system, a shift. Charity came up with a system and said, this is how we're going to do it. And to clear that mail and for people to come and see, wow, they were prolific in what they did. You know, it's what we do all the time. When we organize, we are amazing as a people. And I think
absolutely.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's really important that we have to share that story, because if I don't share that story here in Birmingham, most people won't know about it. It's just been written out in history books. So as somebody that lives here, that somebody talks about here, that somebody understands the city, I'm making sure it's on the radar at every turn and point that I can do. And funny enough, since you left, we've done two more pieces with the BBC and news channels, because they really like this story and keep circling it and circling it. And as long as somebody listens, we'll keep talking about it.
Well, that was really my next question. There seems to be a steep interest among Brits in the 6888. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, one, I'm quite annoying, so I make sure I get it into both places. That's the starting point, really. But no, I think what it is, when we look, you know, when we look at war and history all the time, what we tend to see, it's an industry, and it's mainly a white-populated industry, and it will pick and choose the stories that they want to tell. And there's more significant, and take colour out of it, it's just a fantastic story to hear in itself. But then when you start to look into the personal individual stories and how that connects back to the US and how this connects back to where these women came from and that journey to them getting here, I think it's a really, you know, major human story that needs to be shared. And the fact it's not just, you know, if we know about the Wrens and the Racks and all these different types of women service personnel, but what we don't get to talk about is this unique unit of women that came here and bonded here as well. And as much as we do know, we still don't know enough. We don't know enough about their experience in the UK. You know, we've seen, you know, over the years, we've seen people say they had a great time and stuff as well, but nobody really gets into what did they do when they were here. We know that they mixed with, and this is from a UK side. So we know from their testimonies, the books that's been written, the documentaries, we know what they talk about, their experience being here, but nobody really talks about how they integrated with them when they came here. You know, and they were very visible. So it's not like people said, I didn't know who they were. They were very, very visible at the time.
You know, and it's kind of like my sister and I were lamenting that if we knew what we knew now, we'd have asked my mother more questions. You know, because it's so, you're getting it, you know, we have secondhand accounts. And so there's my generation, you know, many of us did talk to our moms or aunts or grandmothers did talk to us. But that's not the same as talking to someone who was there, you know? I mean, of the person there telling the story themselves. And so, yeah. You know, you just kind of wish, it's like there's so much that we discovered that was like, wow, we wish we could really ask mom about this. And so that's why I think it's important to not lose these things. I mean, in my generation, the baby boomers, we're the next generation. And what we don't capture, those behind us will not have. If we don't tell, if we don't go through the basement, go through these boxes and pull out pictures and files and then just kind of talk about the things that our parents, our mom said, nothing gets passed on to the next generation, which is really why I'm doing this podcast in the first place, to try to make sure we capture this while, you know, before my generation crosses over and joins the ancestors. So.
And, you know, just to add to that, we're not far away now. I mean, if you look at it, this next year is the 80th anniversary of D-Day. So that means everybody that was kind of living is dying out at this moment in time. And like you said, it's not far before, you know, those generations will become a forgotten generation if we don't keep that story.
Right.
People because...
No, go ahead.
No, people sometimes ask me, why is it important to me, as you did at the beginning of the program here? And the reason why it's important is when people want to stand up and talk about how the world is great and how it got there, we need to include everybody. We need to talk about those that took part. I mean, it's quite obvious that, you know, I was just reading yesterday, just a bit of research before I came out today, I was just looking at the US breakdown of servicemen, and like, you've got these horrendous stories about the Reriff 11 who were like, you know, 11 African men from, I think it's the 393rd, who were massacred by Nazis in Germany, more than white soldiers. They actually found out they brutally massacred them before killing them. But they would never talk about those stories now because it's not important. It was whitewashed at the time. It's able to push those stories out. But here are the lives of men and women of the US and what they suffered in what is already an horrendous thing, which is war, you know? And I think it's important for us to actually talk about our contribution. I hate that word, contribution. It makes it like we just did a little part of it. But right. Just the fact that we were extremely involved. Just the fact that, like, if you want to talk about D-Day and everybody landing on D-Day, okay, that's great saying the men who were on the beaches did the fighting, but what about the supply lines that came behind them? Because you couldn't do anything without those supply lines, and fortunately, those right. supply lines were mainly black, you know? Right. And we've got to... So I'm trying to give you the full picture of the battlefield to understand how important our role was, you know? And it wasn't important because we just chose to be in the supply lines. That's where you constructively made sure we ended up. But when we talk about, like, Patton's Black Army, is it 761st? Again, apologies if I got it wrong, but I'm sure that is right at the top of my head. You know, the artillery units that were made up in the Battle of Bastogne as well. You don't see that in things like Band of Brothers. And for
761st, what they call the Black Panthers?
Yeah, the Black Panthers as well.
I was watching a piece that Morgan Freeman had, uncle who was in there, and he did a piece on the Black Panthers recently on one of the networks.
Yeah. And you know, what happened was a couple of years ago, I was doing some research on World War One, and I was looking at, so I covered the whole aspect. This is an American program, so I'm talking mainly about this experience. So I actually did research on all the different American units that took part as well. And one of the interesting things that we see at play is, like, at the time when the British and the French all pulled out of Haiti, we all know Haiti or Haiti, if you want to pronounce it that way, but like, the Americans actually then sneaked into that country and sent troops into there as part of taking it over. And we don't see these land grabs or, you know, what happens in history, that why certain places end up in a particular way. And I found that quite interesting as well, because the Americans didn't want to join in the First World. But again, when we look at it and we see that amazing, famous picture of the jazz band going into war on behalf of the French, because, you know, it's just fascinating pictures like that and stories to talk about it, and the Doughboys.
This is important stuff. So you were in the 2019 documentary 6888, for which Jim Thayers was the executive producer and director. And I interviewed Jim in an episode 8 of the podcast. So how did you come to be involved with that documentary?
So, as I said, if you go back in time, I've been tracking what the 6888 were doing. Now, when the monument was unveiled, I was due to fly out to actually come out to that ceremony.
And Leavenworth, Kansas.
Yeah, Leavenworth, Kansas. Yeah, I was going to come out for myself, but unfortunately, I was doing my I was actually doing a degree in Black Studies, and I was writing my dissertation at that particular time, and I was literally going to have to fly out, come to the ceremony, and fly back, which it just didn't make sense. But I'd been speaking to Edna through that period of time, and now I found her online, and we've been communicating.
So
and
you, I got a phone. Edna, you're referring to Colonel Edna Cummings. We interviewed her in the previous episode too. All right, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've been speaking to her about it and telling her my involvement and what I was doing. And then I got a frantic phone call saying that Jim was flying over, and could I arrange to support him in creating this film, which I thought, that's great, not a problem. I'll take him to the spot. I'll get clearance from the school for him as well. And next thing you know, I ended up being in it, which I think it's one of those conversations we start off, you know, can you do this? And let's say, you know, you're actually in it and you're more involved. So I sourced a film for him, a film crew for him on the UK side, made sure he had the right cameras, equipment, got clearance. We didn't get clearance to go on the school that particular day, but we filmed from outside it. I ended up just talking about my passion, my story, you know, what it means to me as you're asking me here today. and why it's important for me to tell that story. So that's why I ended up in the video, even though some Americans claim that they can't understand me and I speak the Queen's English.
Well, you know, Americans, we're just kind of funny. We think that the way we speak is everyone should speak English and everyone should speak it the way we speak it. And that's cool. Yeah. That comes from a simple lack of exposure. When people travel around the world, they tend to develop a little bit more humility. But, you know,
yeah. America, I think it's that, but
most Americans do not have much humility when it comes down to that.
I think it was that. And the fact is, I have a strong Birmingham accent. So they were talking about using subtitles, which I don't know if I'm offended or...
They actually subtitles for a lot of I'm trying to think. I've seen it so many times. I don't know.
Sure, there's something there somewhere, but it was just quite a funny point at the value.
If they were in there, they weren't just for you. So they were for everybody. So it was a significant honor for the 6888 to receive the Congressional Gold Medal. What was your reaction when you found out? And then I'm wondering if you've had a chance to meet any of the living 6888 soldiers.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, my timeline is fuzzy, but I had the absolute pleasure, just before they won the Congressional Gold Medal, I had the absolute pleasure of interviewing five of the women. I hosted an actual conference that we had with them at the US Embassy in the UK. I think this is probably just before COVID, probably about 2017, 2018. So the US Embassy, when they actually did a visit to the Birmingham School, they put up a blue plaque. I think it was your ambassador, Woody Johnson, that actually came to the school and put the plaque up in recognition of the women. And as part of that, I was asked to come to the US Embassy to host an event where we would speak to five of the women. We had a room of about 200, an audience of about 200 people, including school children from across the UK, who got to talk to them and ask them questions and, you know, find out a bit more. And like you said, I mean, I'm completely honored, this work that I do. I do it all the time. I do it proudly for them, on behalf of them. You know, I make sure that I'm an ambassador to their stories and their journeys and make sure that it stays in living memory as well. So when I heard about the Congressional Gold Medal, me and Edna speak all the time. Edna's crazy because you send her a message at what for us is like the early hours here. And you get, beep, beep, she's back. And you're like, what are you doing awake? You know, with the time difference and stuff as well. But like, yeah, as she's an ambassador, I love to consider myself an ambassador. I'll do absolutely everything I can to ensure this story lives on. The gold medal, I mean, I was aware of it before. I was aware of it since I started the protest. She'd been informing me what they needed to do, how to do it. So I've been very much engaged in it. And just to see that it was actually awarded. And I'm going to say something here, which I might get shot down, but I'll just claim I'm English and I don't know the difference. I think I think it was beautiful to see it was done after Trump was in power, because that would have been a bit of a weird scenario. I don't know what you guys think, but I thought that would have been a weird scenario for him to have awarded it to them.
Well, it might not have gotten awarded, but that's neither here nor there. So, yes, I'm happy that it happened under President Biden. If it couldn't happen under President Obama, at least it happened under President Biden, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and we're hopefully looking forward to, at some point, it's going to get minted, and, you know, we'll see who's in office then. So you're going to come up when they actually have the ceremony?
Yeah, definitely.
And we're hoping that somebody will still be alive from the 6888. You know, Romay Davis, the oldest living 6888 soldier, turned 104 on October the 29th. So,
you know, she's definitely hanging on.
Yeah, she is. And you know, one of the things we learned recently is that two of her brothers were in the Montreport Marines.
Oh, wow.
And so that's the first Black Marines to serve in World War II. There were 20,000 of them. And they have Congressional Gold Medals also, that battalion. So that's amazing. We can talk about that, talk about that offline, tell you what I found out so far.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, because I'm also interviewing descendants of their descendants as well.
Yeah.
On the podcast. So if you were thinking about it, what important lessons, kind of the global thought, what important lessons have you learned from your research on the 6888 soldiers? I mean, things are just kind of,
you know, as you're saying that question, I'm just looking at all my books here. So I've got the five or six books on charity, Kaya Alderson's Sister in Arms. I'm looking at Dig for Dictory. Was it Barbara's work, To Serve My Country, To Serve My Race?
Yes.
Can I use those all?
Yeah, I can't remember who the author was. Is that Brenda Moore's book?
Brenda Moore, that was it. I'm just looking here to see what he's got a label stuck over it.
Yeah.
But I suppose the reason I'm looking at those books and you ask about what is the global story that we learn, what we see is even in times of crisis and war and situations, we can still be written out of the main narrative. That's deliberate. That's personally deliberate. When we look at war and we look at how much involvement we had as a people, how much involvement we had as it as a people and the reasons why, because that's what's important. You know, we didn't just go to war because we wanted to do part. We were actually fighting to better our own race, to better our own position, you know, as well, to better our own narrative, past, present, and future, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And I think for me, what I'm looking at the global picture is how those experiences are similar. Let's be honest, let's not glorify war in any shape or form. But in any type of war that you want to go back to, whether it be, you know, the Civil War in the US, you know, the Roman Empire here in Britain, we always find traces of Black people within that. And what does it mean to serve in an environment that isn't suited to you at times? So I'm going to go in with this real about identity. I want to talk about Black identity. I want to talk about sociology. I want to talk about positions. You know, most people from the Caribbean served up because it was part of take out the adventure part. It's also about a way of trying to better your life and be seen as if I fight or serve, I'll be then seen as an equal. And it's really alarming that the women that came here, when they went back, they were still in fights for civil rights, for civil justice as well. And I think that's the part we're missing. We're looking at the social story, the social narrative that's actually manipulated to talk about, you know, you hear often, you know, it was one of the bloodiest battles of the war. Well, all wars are bloody. How do you actually categorize that? Well, why aren't you saying that Black people also served in an absolutely fantastic way in discipline? You know, I think it was just this week, wasn't it? Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. And again, I know this doesn't sound like we're talking about this Triple Eight of points, but this Triple Eight served and created opportunities for people going forward. But going backwards, what we do is we need to find that they stood on the shoulders of other people as well.
Right.
And wasn't it just week that the US announced that they pardoned 110 US personnel from World War I who were either shut at dawn or court-martialed in, you know, different ways to white soldiers?
I may have missed that. We have a little bit, more than a little bit of chaos going on in the United States.
I read that story.
Yeah.
No, I read that story this week because I think it shared on quite. I'm on a lot of platforms in the US as well, and Edna shares everything with me as well. So
she'll keep you busy reading. Yes.
Yeah. So it's like I was saying with that as well. It's just understanding our position because nothing can happen without understanding the past, and it's the past that informs us of the future. And no matter how much you look back in time, if you want to go forward right to the colonial wars, there were Black people fighting on both sides in that as well. Nobody ever talks about it. So we have got this long history of service and, you know, the service with the military as well. But why isn't our story told in the same way as everybody else's?
I think
that's really important.
You know, as you know, there's a significant pushback in certain sectors of the U.S. about teaching Black history. How did the Brits react to the teaching of Black history? Are you haven't getting some of the same pushback, or if not, there's some line between pushback and ignoring, you know. So I was just curious as that, because we in certain of our states, which remain nameless to protect the guilty, certain of our states, you've got a lot of crazy legislation going on to try to basically wipe out our history.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is the reason we track what's happening in the US, because it kind of sets the trend. You know, you asked at the beginning of the question, how we're experiencing it. We've got some plays of exactly the same thing happening in the UK at the moment as well. So
they just happen not to be running for prime minister, right?
Well, our last prime minister was part of the cause of it as well, because he's very much of this idea of doing this, creating these narratives and, you know, instead of actually fixing things that are broken, breaking things to try and fix them to look great and pander to particular parts of the country.
I think we experienced that in the last recent years.
Just to give you some examples that we're fighting here, about 3 years ago during the COVID, The Commonwealth War Graves Commission, which is equivalent to your Arlington Cemetery and your national cemetery there. So we have a similar thing around the world where graves are protected by this organisation. And they wrote a report saying that basically they'd realised the errors of their ways, what they'd done, how they hadn't actually protected some of the graves that contained black soldiers and Muslim, Asian, Sikhs across the world. So they came out and admitted it, put their hands up. What was interesting wasn't the fact the backlash of, oh, you haven't looked after our military personnel. It was more a case of, why are you being woke? And we've got this word that's been twisted around here now as well. The narrative of wokeness has been twisted around.
I'm sure they got that from the United States also.
Absolutely. So we get maybe a watered down version, but the same sort of pushback as well, which is why I find it important to merge the two histories into one, because it's world history.
Right.
That's the bottom line, world history. And what happens is people play, I didn't know that. Well, Gary Stewart lives in Birmingham. And as far as he's here, the 6888 is going to be known about, you know. So you can't play that game with me here. But that's the reason why I'm supportive, I'm passionate about it. That's the reason why I make sure the story is told. And the fact as well, I didn't say this in the beginning, but, you know, it's African American women, you know, it's black women. You saw these women, you know what they did, you know. So let's make sure it stays on the table for the conversations.
Yep, absolutely. And I'm committed to that. So let's talk a little bit about you and your background and career. You're a native of Birmingham, and your parents are of Jamaican heritage.
Jamaica when they were young. So
tell me about your educational background and career. I know you were in the British Royal Army. Is that?
Yeah, so I was in the British Army. I was in the Royal Regiment, the Royal Corps of Signals. So we were the communicators for the whole British Army as well. My particular job, so I used to provide high voltage power to all the communications vehicles so they can communicate and service their generators. So that's a job that I chose. It gave me, you know, when you join the military, they always say, make sure you get qualifications, skills. So I did engineering and I did that particular job, did it quite well. And then I think for me, I only served for a short period of time, 6 or 7 years. But all the time I've been looking at what I would do next. And when I came out, I had no idea what that was going to be. So as a more service personnel, I did a bit of period in sales. Then I actually went to a telecommunications company just as I'm going to share my age here, but just as the mobile revolution kicked off, I joined a telecoms company. And then I was involved in mobile telecoms for over 20 years as well. So, but I've always, the history side, that really comes from a personal passion. That was me understanding. When I served, I had no idea as many black people had served in the British Army until I came out. It's just not talked about in there. Or, you know, you don't see, you know, the regiment I joined had a high, large of black personnel because our current king now had decreed at the time that we needed more black people in the British Army as well. My regiment was one of those that took the call because it was a technical regiment. So a lot of the guys, I was used to seeing black guys, although my first regiment I went to, I was the only black guy in a regiment of 220 people. So you can imagine those experiences, having to drive home 240 miles round trip to go and do what I call blacking up. I'd go home, buy all my black hair products because I had hair at that time, yes. I'd buy my Blues and Soul magazine, I'd buy that. I'd go and get the black newspaper, UK newspaper that told me. I'd go home, get all this stuff and then come back, you know, and then I felt I was, you know, I could culturally appropriate myself back in my own culture. You know, so it could be lonely times at times. Could be lonely and challenging times.
People have no idea a lot of times for some of these kinds of experiences when you're the only one in a particular place. And that certainly those situations happen even today. So it's not just history; it's still current, sadly.
I was 18 at the time. I think I was 18 at the time, so it was really interesting that I'm trying to immerse myself in this world that I know nothing about. And then I also identify that I have to also keep myself immersed in my own world. You know, there's many times my mum will be up, she goes, dinner's going to be on the table at 6, shame you're not here. And I'll jump in my car and I'll be at that table by 6:05. You know, so I used to do that a lot. But I just thought that, I think when we're talking about that experience, that's why I talk about the 6888 women, coming here at a time where, you know, hair products, they managed to get their hair, you know, number one point for women, hair. they brought those products with them, and you know, even though they said they had to scrap and scrape to do it, they had their own hair salon. You know, in a normal story, that doesn't look important, but we know how important that must have been to them at the time.
Absolutely. What people don't understand is they had to be a self-contained unit and provide everything they needed to live for themselves.
Yeah.
So, and the women came from a lot of different backgrounds, and that's what made that possible.
So, and I think when they were here as well, I mean, there's a part of the story that's not talked about really, which I am kind of working on. And I know you guys went to London, but I don't think it actually happened very well, which was there was a club called the Colonial Club. And most who do speak about it, talk about going there when they went on R&R to London.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them, because all the black service personnel and all the black Londoners would meet at this particular club called the Colonial Club. And I've seen people mention it, and I've seen one or two pictures from there. I haven't seen those 6888 ladies in it. But it's just interesting to know that, like, they came here, they went to London, they saw, they would have immersed themselves, they would have seen more people like them in that particular region. But also just the fact that they had this particular club that most of them must have went to it. I can't say how they didn't, because it was one of the few places where they could have gone to listen to music that represented them, to see people with them, and to go to the dances where people looked like them and felt like them.
Yeah, I have to go back. One of these days, when we're not on the podcast, I have to go back and pull up some of the images, the photos that my mother took, and I can't quite place them. So you may be able to help me place them.
That'd be fun.
So now you said you got a degree in Black Studies, and where was that? The University of Birmingham, or
Birmingham City University. The other way around, I've got to get it. So we've got several universities here. Which actually, that does lead to another point that we talked about before, where I've actually found a record of two or three of the women actually visiting the debate society at Birmingham University. So just for the listeners, we have several universities in Birmingham. But Birmingham University is the one, when you look at that famous picture of the women stood on the road, the Bristol Road, in front of the huts and charities inspecting them, you can see the tall clock tower in the background.
Okay.
That's the university. And I've actually found in their documents, they normally record what happens in the year. There's a mention of three women from the 6888 going there to debate in society. That's about as far. I don't know what they were debating, but that's about as far. But the fact is, they immersed themselves in the local community.
So Trinity University there's a Trinity University in England, isn't there?
Yeah, Trinity, which is part of Oxford. You hear about two famous universities.
Yeah, Oxford, because I've heard stories of the women taking classes at Trinity, and then some places also.
But again, you asked me about my degree. So I did a degree, and we just had the first Black Studies degree. Now, I know that's quite prevalent across the US, but in the UK, we never had a specific degree like that taken by a university. So I just completed that last year. And, you know, I talk about, I was going to do my dissertation originally on Black service personnel and that experience, but it was too wide a subject. You know, you've got to narrow it down, and it just didn't do justice as well. But I still continue this work in Black Studies. It forms part of the work that recognized us, one of our companies.
So what was the topic of your dissertation?
So in the end, I did, oh God, you know what? It was only last year. I can't even think in the last year.
What was the subject of it? You narrowed the topic down.
I moved away from the military, and I think I wrote my dissertation. Oh, I wrote my dissertation on Black History Month. And the reason for that was, we have Black History Month here. We have ours in a different month. You do yours in February. We do October. It's based on the seasons here. And also,
right,
we think it takes a priority if it's at the start of the term rather than at the end of the term. Just the way our schooling system works here. Black History has been 40 years in the UK in its current guise. As you know, we have a whole month celebration as well. Some people complain we only get a month. I get 365 days because I'm black by nature, black by colour, and black by breed. So,
you plan to celebrate it every day, right?
I celebrate it every day. I don't have an option to celebrate every day. I'm black every day I go out. So I experience blackness every single day, you know, whether that be positive or negative. So I don't know how people get to choose and say, who are they, only give us a month. And who's giving me a month, you know?
Right.
So... It's a funny thought, isn't it? That people
it's only a month, and other people pay attention to it.
Yeah.
When you're living it, it's 24/7.
And as I say, it's 24/7 to live it. But October is the month for us that we showcase. That's what we're meant to be doing: showcase to the world what we do, how we've done it, and what we're going to do as well. Whether that be in STEM, Anything that we do, we have to just promote ourselves in that month.
Okay, keep me posted. Maybe next October I'll head your way. That's a beautiful month to travel. So
yeah, definitely come here. There's a lot, you know, that's probably the best time to see what blackness in Britain looks like at other times, and depending what city you go to, you know. But that's one month where every city you go to, they'll be doing something around blackness as well.
Okay.
You know, and yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the organization, Recognize Black Heritage and Culture. You do a lot of different, you have a lot of different things you do. So let's talk about your work and your organization, what type of work you do.
Yeah, so Recognize, which is my organization, so Recognize Black Heritage and Culture, it started off as an organization that just promoted anything about blackness. We try to avoid the negative and literally just promote stories that we're here, which is why I cross over with the US. We're talking about blackness on a global scale. We're mm-hmm. talking about it from identity politics. We're talking about it from lived experience. We're celebrating those high stories as well. And we try and stay away from the negative stories. You know why? There's enough people that can do that.
Right.
We're trying to promote.
Just turn on the news for the negative stories, right?
Sorry.
I said all you have to do is turn on the news to get the negative stories.
Well, you know, turn on the news, negative stories as well. You know, we're always in this cycle of fighting, you know, fighting for our lives, fighting for stories, fighting to achieve, fighting to go to college, to university. You know, we're fighting everything in this world as well. So I just try and pick out the good fights and say, this is where we've had the wins and this is what we need to do. And these are the people that done it as well. And I think that's really important for me. I mentor young kids as well.
I was going to say, because a lot of times young kids, you know, they see all these negative images portrayed of black people, and they don't know the rich history from which they come.
Yeah, and for me, I think what it is, when I started doing Recognize, I just started doing it because I just felt I needed to do it as a channel. But what's been proven to me is over the 15 years that we've been running it, you know, we started off doing. I remember my first presentation. I did a story on, you know, black soldiers in World War I Britain. Oh my God, it's got to have been probably one of the worst, boring presentations in the world. You know, I'm not going to lie. I was bored listening to myself, you know. But what I did over the time is I took lessons and presentations, understand how to make it important and stuff as well. You know, I've been to events where I've been speaking to 200-300 people, and people are hanging on what I'm saying because, one, they didn't know, and two, they want to learn more as well. So I now have an obligation to make sure when I deliver something, it's, you know, it's worth delivering because people are listening. And what they're also listening to is for me to get it wrong, you know. So I, you know, so that's where we came from. But what I've done in the other work is I have 3 or 4 other companies as well. So I'm director of Recognize. I'm director of an organization called Black Heritage Walks Network. You met them when you came on the tour.
Right,
We did the walking and tour guides because, you know, it's quite popular. A lot of the stuff we take is from the US, but Black Heritage tours are quite popular in the US. If you came to Birmingham before we were doing them, there's been 1 or 2 attempts at them before, but there really wasn't anything constructive underground. So if you come to Birmingham, you would have walked through the city. You wouldn't have heard about the 6888. You wouldn't have seen where Nelson Mandela, Malcolm X came to England. I mean, the hotel you guys stayed in, the Grand Hotel, was the hotel that Malcolm X stayed in when he came here.
Right.
Yeah, there's no plaque inside to tell you that. There's not one piece of history that would have told you that story.
Yeah. So you know? I know you're working on that too.
Yeah, we're working on that at the moment. So the region that Malcolm X came to and he went to visit the houses, the poor houses, to say that it's worse than Birmingham, Alabama, that particular city council is 50 years old next year. And they're going to celebrate that. And I'm going to celebrate it, but I'm going to celebrate Malcolm X. I probably should announce that before it happens, but I don't think they'll be best pleased about that story. Because, you know, again, it talks about the similar shared experiences that we're experiencing here, where black people were being told they weren't allowed to buy houses in this region.
Right.
So, you know, but yeah, so the walking tour group, that's really popular. We set that up as a tourist attraction. So we try and make sure it's run properly. You buy tickets, feedback, it's on TripAdvisor. We've really worked hard to make sure it's a tourism offering, just like everything else, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then, sorry, another organization that I actually run is one called the Windrush Caribbean Film Festival. And that's a much newer organization.
That's exactly, you must have been reading my mind. That was exactly where I was going next. I don't know that most people in the audience probably don't know about Windrush, what it is and why it's so important. So please go right ahead.
Yeah, so for those that don't know, after the Second World War finished in Britain for the British servicemen personnel that came from the Caribbean, most of them went back home to the Caribbean. But then the British put out a call saying, look, after the war, Britain is broken structurally, mentally, physically, and it needed help. So we asked a lot of people from the Caribbean to actually come to the UK to get the jobs in the factories so it could rebuild itself. And it so happens a lot of those, that call particularly went out to ex-service personnel who had already had experience of England and had just gone back after the war. So the British actually were sending a ship, it was actually sailing back from South America, and they diverted it to the Caribbean and said to Caribbean people, if you pay £28, British pounds, you'll be able to get on the ship and come to the UK, we'll look after you, you'll be able to get jobs and help to rebuild Britain, which is the mother country of the UK. That's how they sold it. Sounds quite convincing, doesn't it? So those people came here and experienced...
Only if it works, right?
Well, only if you want it to work, which they obviously didn't at the time. So most of those people came over in a particular ship that was called the SS Empire Windrush. And if you Google that story, you'll find it out there. 500 Jamaicans came to Britain. It wasn't 500 Jamaicans. It was 500 people from across the whole of the Caribbean that came. But it wasn't the first ship. And this is why I said history is important. So you'll see it billed as the first ship that carried Caribbean people to come and settle in the UK post-war. It wasn't. There had been three ships previously, as much as a year before, but they were carrying small numbers. But again, it's just how you change the narrative, change the story as well. So you whip up a storm amongst the British population who have now reverted to their type of racism because the Americans have left. And they're now going back to their racism, which is we don't want them people here. So you see why it's important. Right. And, you know, we've gone from the top of the podcast to the bottom. We've got that same theme, different types of racism that fit and suit when and as, if that makes sense. Sorry.
Right.
So what you then get is the population in Britain now, most of them came over. Although Britain had a black population, beat small, a lot of that population started coming to the UK in 1948 on the Empire Windrush and many other ships. And then when we started commercial flights, a lot of them would fly via the BALC. So, so many of those that came under Empire Windrush in that particular generation were the first pioneers who laid the groundwork for the communities that are here today. My grandmother came in 1963. So she came here, set up, sent back from members of the family. And again, it's not just a case of sending for their family to come here. We have this story of human emotion where families were broken apart because one member of the family would be here and the rest of the family would be in Jamaica or whichever Caribbean island. And then you've got these broken families that have been broken down now by distance because, you know, economically, people came here to earn money. They had a 5-year plan. You know, they were going to come to England, work for 5 years and then go back to the Caribbean. And obviously that doesn't happen. So most of them end up with families that are split as well. And I don't think people look at the actual, you know, the 6AAA women would have done that when they all moved around the country as well. And then, you know, they went back and then some of them settled in different areas from where they came. You know, it doesn't talk about the history and geography of how people are broken up and how families are split up, you know, because of the way that we're treated.
Right. So last year was it the what year celebration was it? The big celebration this past year, 2020.
75th anniversary.
75th anniversary of Windrush, which is quite an event.
It was. Yeah. And you know, when Edna spoke to me about the trip, I did tell her that wasn't a good day because it was part of this, this major celebration that was happening that hadn't been given the gravitas in the UK that it should have been. So what you witnessed this year was us all coming together and making sure it was actually marked on the map. And I'm pleased to say that you're in many pictures. You took part in the events where it was as well. I know it wasn't directly to do with the 6AAA, but I think it just told a story that there'd been black people in Birmingham before the Windrush arrived as well. And those people.
I think it provided a valuable history lesson for those of us about blacks in the UK. So.
Yeah. I think it was just important for us to embed you in that story because to me, again, as the historian that I am and the type of way that I look at history, it was a continuation. So when people from the Caribbean communities came back here, because don't forget a lot of them were here already, when they came back, we're also saying, don't look at us as if you don't know us, because before the Jamaicans and the Caribbeans were here, the 6AAA were here, and they were African-American, and they definitely would have stood out by their accent and their colour. So
right.
you you understand it. You know, you've been mixing with these people. It's not new to you. Stop acting as if, like, you know, black people have just arrived on the earth and you didn't, you know, you don't know how to mix or, you know, because that's how people play it sometimes, isn't it? That's what they do. They're trying to say, we don't know how to mix with them.
Yeah, you're so right. It's just scary that we're still doing this. And it's still happening in 2023.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you can see now. If you're going to say, you can see now. If you go back, you can see why the sixth replacement story forms an important part, even though it's American history in that regard. It's also an important part of British history because it happened here.
Right.
So I just hope that gives you a clear picture of why.
I wonder if the French feel the same way since after the soldiers finished their tour of duty in England, they went on to France. So I have no idea how the French view it. Yeah, so I understand you've been doing some filming with 6888 related filming over the BBC over King Edward School. Of course, we know that's a very significant school for the 6888. You want to talk a little bit about that significance of that school as well as about your filming project?
Yeah, so for those, again, who don't know, I don't know how much viewers or listeners out there are actually looked into the story. So if you look at the school, the pictures that most people would have seen of, again, charity inspecting the women, and that was on their first day here. You'll see just behind them, there are some wooden huts. And what it was, the 6888 moved into what was the old King Edward School. At the time it was being built and during the war, it was a beautiful brick building, which we've all visited. So that's the pictures that you see of us and the descendants there. But prior to that, it was the old school that the women are stood in front of when they're parading. So once the women left, that part of the school was ripped down, but the original brick building is still there as well. And like I said, if you look at any of the descendants' pictures there, you'll see us standing outside the school at the front, at the back, and also standing in the position where the women were stood in 1945 at the time as well. It looks very much exactly the same. So the school kind of heard the story, but since I've been involved in it, we brought that story to life. We've spoken to some of our local TV stations, and there's one particular station or channel that as soon as we call, they'll turn up and record. So after you guys left, we filmed there. I think we filmed when they were there, wasn't it? At the time, if I'm right, Doc?
The
TV cameras were there when we were there at the time.
I think there was some cameras outside on the street. Yeah.
Yeah, they filmed. Yeah, in fact, you spoke. I'm sure you were interviewed. Did you not see that one?
Well, we were interviewed over at the by Windrush over at the in front of the building where the Windrush is being held. That's where my sister and daughter and I were interviewed.
Yeah, I'm sure you.
There were some other people. I think I remember now the Martin family. I think may have been interviewed in front of the school.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'll double check that footage, but I'm sure you're on it as well. Maybe I've got the long version. But so we have one TV channel in particular that will always, if we say we're going to film something there, they'll come and record. So we recorded when you guys were here. I've recorded once again since you guys have left, and that was aired a couple of weeks ago. Now, there's been some filming, but there's a bit of controversy about this. So Tyler Perry has done a film for Netflix, but unfortunately, he didn't come to Birmingham to film any of the scenes at all. They were all filmed in other cities and at one of our World War II exhibitions. And we've had no input or context or conversation with him about that, which is a bit of a shame, really, because the school actually want to actually do a preview of the film at the school because the connection. Most of viewers won't know this, but those members of the descendants that came to Birmingham, when we actually stood, we recreated the famous picture and they stood in the spot. I can't say they got emotional. Let's say we all got emotional because when I introduced to you guys what was happening at the time, I got emotional trying to explain to you guys where your parents and grandmothers had stood in that spot as well. And we just felt a spiritual connection. That's part of the reason why I like to talk about the story to make sure it remains in history as well. There's been some talk of when we do the play, if the play comes to the UK, I know it's a Broadway play, but doing a part at the school. And what you won't know, this is a world exclusive to the listeners here. The school have a blue plaque outside, as I mentioned before, which was put up by US Ambassador Woody Johnson as well, but it was really a temporary blue plaque. You've seen it. You had your picture taken outside it, Doc, as well, if you remember.
Yes. Yeah. I do have the picture.
Yep. You remember,
The school. I do have it, yes.
Yeah, the school have just given permission to reinstall a more permanent blue plaque there.
That's great. So, you keep giving me all these compelling reasons to come back.
Yeah. But that's not the only thing.
I'm gonna set my Google flight alerts for fares to. Can you fly directly into Birmingham, or do we have to
you
go
can.
Through?
Good, no, you can. It's sometimes cheaper.
Good, because I want to avoid Heathrow at all costs. So all right. So I'm gonna have to set my Google alerts for fares to come there and get back. Keeping us COVID, man.
I'm just looking for a significant date to do it as well. But also, they want a permanent exhibition there now. I met with the chief master recently. She wants a permanent exhibition there of the women in the school. So I've got to look into that. And then there's talk about putting a third plaque up on the other outside the other school, so it actually becomes a tourist attraction.
Okay.
So, you know, that's some fantastic work that's, you know, we're continuing. This is what we're doing in the background.
So I have, as we wrap up today, I have two more questions. And this is kind of, what lessons from the 6888 story can you share to inspire young Blacks to embrace fear's opportunity so they know that they can break glass ceilings and be their best selves?
There's a couple of things. It depends which age group we're talking about. So let's work backwards. The older generation need to understand the importance of what they've achieved. Sometimes people actually minimize their achievements. And I think anything that people have done before is that has got us in the position we are today. If you think about it, it's only one generation back, you're two generations back, where you're talking about people being sons and daughters of slaves, you know? And, you know, I once said to this guy, a guy was arguing with me at work at the time, and I ended the conversation with him like this. Isn't it a shame after 400 years of slavery that you and I sit at the same table and I'm in a higher position than you and probably paid more than you, you know? And laughing and joking aside, I said that to him because it was just showing him the importance. That means one of two things. It even means that me and my community have excelled and we are now sat at the same table as him. Or what has he been doing for the last 400 years when he was in a position of privilege? And I think that's the question that actually riled him. It really took him. And like, laughing and joking aside, I did that deliberately because it was just to set the context. Either we can see him as achievers and we've arrived, or he can be seen as somebody that's just lived his privileged life and, you know, trying to put us down, constantly working against us to still be in the same position he was in 400 years ago, pretty much. And, you know, you'll hear them say, oh, well, there were poor white people too. We're not talking about being poor and white. We're being talked about systematically held back. You know, that's what we're talking about. And I think for me, that's one of the big stories the 6888 overcome. And anybody who feels that they're struggling to make these achievements, you know, in a more relative, calmer world that we are, I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's better than it was for them. You know, they had to do all the fighting for us. It only means you only have one job, which is to exceed what they did because you are part of their legacy. And I think that's a key point. I think people forget that. They just think you're just here, you're just doing what you're doing, but you're a legacy of, you know, you, and I am pointing at you, I know listeners can't see, but I'm pointing at your picture. You're a legacy of your mother that's now got your granddaughter, her granddaughter, which your legacy, we're all legacies one down.
We all came here on the shoulders of somebody else, and we need to be shoulders for the next generations.
Yeah. And for those in our community that fail, you know, I'll talk to everybody, good and bad. You can always make a difference tomorrow. You know, you might be up to no badness today. You might not be successful today. But you know what? You can change that tomorrow by doing something different. And I think that's what is important, because some people have achieved in a time where they weren't even meant to, and they still did it. So what does that mean?
It's never too late. As long as you're still here, it's never too late to make a difference.
Yeah. I did my degree at a certain later age. I won't say how much, but much later in life, you know, and I did it. It was a challenge. I did it through COVID, which made it even more difficult. But, you know, I now have a degree in Black Studies. What has that done for me? It opens up the work that I do, not just on 6888, but it opens up the work for me as a Black historian. You know, that's the key thing. You know, I don't have a history degree, but I'm able to talk about it. People now listen, you know, and that's important.
Yeah. Finally, I'm sure that members of the audience may want to find out more about your work. How can you be contacted? Do you have a web address or email address that you can share?
Yeah. So my web address is www.recognize, and it is spelled the American way with a Z, online.com. Now, how many people, because I don't spell it the English way, because it just doesn't look right when it's written down for me.
I know.
So, yeah, you can find me on www.recognizeonline.com. If you want to email me, it's gary@recognizeonline.com. If you want to find out more about the walking tour and some of the work we've done, so on the Recognize page, there's a few videos about the 6888 on there, and one or two of the previous BBC interviews that we've actually done. If you want to find out a bit more about the walking tour, the 6888 walking tour that we have in Birmingham now, that's also on my website, which is Black Heritage Walks Network at Gmail. BlackHeritageWalkNetwork.com.
Okay. So people know how to find you, and hopefully they will follow up and do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I'm very, very grateful for you spending the time with us. And like I said, I'm looking forward to getting back over there to do some more visiting and in your
hometown. I've got the party arranged. We didn't party hard last time, so I've got the party.
Okay, arranged. All right. Okay, looking forward to that. We won't announce the date online. We don't want all the strangers coming up. So
you as well for taking the time to interview us. I know it's been a couple of months since you were here, but like I said to, you know, the listeners, the work hasn't stopped and we're in constant communication. You know, we spoke, 3 weeks ago for half an hour. That turned into 2.5 hours because there was so much to talk. So I'm always happy to talk and share the information that we have as well, you know.
Okay, well, thank you again.
No, thank you. The pleasure is all mine. Thank you for believing in us and listening to us as well and supporting us in the work that we're doing. We really appreciate it.
To my audience, thank you for listening to Nexus 818 Podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nexus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nexus818podcast@gmail.com. I'd like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Given all the disruption in the world around us, tonight I will share a prayer entitled Liturgy for Ordinary Radicals. Peacemaking doesn't mean passivity. It is the act of interrupting injustice without mirroring injustice. The act of disarming evil without destroying the evildoer. The act of finding a third way that is neither fight nor flight, but careful, arduous pursuit of reconciliation and justice. It is about a revolution of love that is big enough to set both the oppressed and the oppressor free. See you for our next show on Wednesday, December 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Google Podcasts, New York City Podcast Network, and Spotify for podcasters.